Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. It was an incredible trip to Rome, Italy, where in addition to covering the Ryder Cup at Marco Simone Golf Club, I had the opportunity to visit some of the most historic sites there, the Vatican Museum, magnificent churches. There's just so much to see. And had a chance to visit with cousins on my Liguori side, and that was such a treat. And Scott and I did take a side trip to Tuscany to Argentario Golf and Wellness Resort on a peninsula just 90 miles from Rome, where we played golf, went to the spa, visited several of the historic seaside villages, and really enjoyed a peaceful few days before heading back to Roma for the Ryder Cup. And I found this Ryder Cup to be truly compelling on several levels. The European team played brilliant from the get-go. Their captain, Luke Donald, showed smarts and class. There were side stories, mostly on the American side, speculation on why Patrick Cantlay would not wear his hat, why Cantlay's caddy, Joe LaCava, caused Rory McIlroy to get very angry on the 18th at the end of Saturday's four-ball competition. And this morning, you'll hear my analysis of the Ryder Cup and these side stories. Matt Adams, whose booth was next to mine in the media tent at Marco Simone in Rome. Matt is a commentator with Ryder Cup International Radio, and he's also the host of Fairways to Life, and you see him on NBC Sports and the Golf Channel. And we break down what caused the United States to lose on the road for the third decade, as Europe dominated from the very beginning of the three-day competition and closed this one out 16.5 points to 11.5. We look at the side stories, whether players in the Ryder Cup should get paid, what Xander Schauffele's father, Stefan, has been vocal about, how the Marco Simone venue held up, and much, much more. I think you'll really enjoy the insight. Then we turn our attention to the 2027 Ryder Cup, which will take place in Ireland at the beautiful Adair Manor, which is south of Shannon Airport, south of Limerick, in the southwest region of Ireland. Catherine Martin, the Minister for Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport, and Media for Ireland, she joins me to talk about the next Ryder Cup overseas in Ireland, which will take place 2 years after our own Bethpage Black hosts the next Ryder Cup in 2025. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori, and joining me now after an incredible week in Roma covering the Ryder Cup is Matt Adams, host of Fairways of Life, which airs weekdays at 8 a.m. Eastern on all digital platforms, airing nationally across the United States on various platforms and streaming on YouTube, MSG Network in this tri-state area. Matt also works for NBC, the Golf Channel, and is a New York Times best-selling author. What a Ryder Cup, Matt Adams. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Ann. Thank you very much. Yeah, you know, it's funny because like any sporting event, many times people measure it from stem to stern based upon whether their team won or lost. And when it comes to the Ryder Cup, it is such an incredibly inspiring event in every way. I mean, even when you look at it from the perspective of where we went for the last two Ryder Cups held in Europe, we went from Paris to Rome. I mean, you can't make that up. And I thought the Italians did a fantastic job hosting this event. The Ryder Cup is a massive, massive sporting event. If I had to put it into a percentage, I would say a fraction, it would be five times the size of, say, a major championship in golf. That's how big just the logistics and infrastructure is of the Ryder Cup. And I thought they did a wonderful job with everything that they had to do, which is so many pieces and so many thousands of people. And to have it in the shadow of the Eternal City, it was just magical. It was really magical. And that's got nothing to do with what took place between the ropes.
Absolutely. Marco Simone Golf Club. First of all, I think it was the best venue of any Ryder Cup that I've ever covered. And I go back to Brookline in 99. It was just magical. The fan, friendliness and the way that the elevation and the vistas, how beautiful it showed off, not only the countryside, but you could see, parts of Rome if you were high enough. And just all the engagement that they did for the spectators and the fans with the billboards everywhere and the added DJ and the music. And it was so well done that it makes me very proud to be half Italian because they really put on quite a show. And the golf course itself was just a wonderful course to showcase match play. And of course, it ended on the drivable par four 16th hole, which is what they probably intended it to happen anyway. So let me just tell you my overall thoughts, and then I'd love your opinion on this, because we had the pleasure of sitting next to each other. Our booths were next to each other in the media tent, although you were rarely there as you were broadcasting for the Ryder Cup World Feed. And I think the European team just outdid themselves. They outplayed and outsmarted the Americans. They combined brilliant play with really smart strategy. And Europe captain Luke Donald was extremely impressive in every which way, in the way he handled the team on and off the course, in his speech at the opening ceremony, at the way he used stats and analytics to set up the course to Europe's strengths and to the USA's weaknesses, in the way he pretty much handled everything. It was just a brilliant performance, I thought, by Luke Donald. And of course, they played so well, the European team, that, there was just so many, the shot making was unbelievable. You could fill hours and hours on a highlight reel. So I really think that they deserve all the credit. And there are some issues with the United States, and we'll get into that. But just overall, Matt, what were your thoughts?
Well, for all of the events that I have covered, whether we're talking about PGA Tour events or European Tour events, now called DP World Tour, major championships, Solheim Cups, President's Cups, Ryder Cups, I saw shots at the Ryder Cup in Rome that were the best that I've ever seen. And interestingly, many times these shots came with a wedge in hand. You know, and when you look at the wedge in a player's bag, anybody's bag, the bags of people that are right now part of this conversation with us, how many times is it a wedge that you would point to say that that's where glory lies? Usually it's a driver, an approach shot, oftentimes with putter, and there was plenty of opportunities for that with the putter too this week. But I saw players do things with wedges that were some of the most glorious shots that I've ever seen. And those that stand out in my mind, of course, are Jon Rahm multiple times. I watched Max Homa chip in at 15, the par four 15th, from a spot that it was impossible to do what he did. It was impossible to do what he did. And then Max Homa, of course, on Sunday, keeping the hopes alive for another hour or two because he had to take an unplayable at 18. And again, he used the wedge to get up and down and save par, preserve a one-up victory in a singles match. And that's just a couple of examples of things that we saw with wedges. Rory hit a shot with a wedge on 17 that Sophie Walker, a former LET player that's now an international golf broadcaster, told me it was the best shot that she's ever seen, again, with a wedge. So those things to me stood out remarkably with what we saw. And that's kind of what happens with the Ryder Cup, is it causes players to channel not only their best, but they exceed what they do at their best. And there are many examples of players that throughout their career, while great players individually, they never quite reached the heights of what they did at a Ryder Cup. And I don't know, there's something about that sounds kind of really cool too, that you could be a great Ryder Cup player and that in essence defines your career. Nothing wrong with that. And the last of all these things is that goes to what you were saying. The European Tour deserves credit, and the European team, for that matter, the European Tour controls the European side of the European Ryder Cup, deserves credit for what they built from a structure standpoint, from a culture standpoint, from an event standpoint, and ultimately the fact that they performed as well as they did to win the cup. Because universally, there's always going to be that the question asked of, did Europe win this Ryder Cup or did the United States lose this Ryder Cup? And I think emphatically Europe won this Ryder Cup with the way that they performed. But that doesn't take away from the fact, Anne, that there were mistakes made on the American side and they were revealed as we progressed. And in my mind, if you're going to put together a team and you have a structure where it's six that automatically qualify, in six that are captain's picks, because your mentality is, and it came out of COVID with Steve Stricker Whistling Straits, was we want players that are hot right now. And if you're going to augment that by saying we're going to use analytics to make sure that we have the six players that are perfect for all things considered as best as we possibly can, but then you're going to take a right turn and go, yeah, but we also asked the players over, you know, whatever means they did it. I'll say for this discussion over dinner to say, yeah, but who else do you want on the team? And you end up putting players on the team because you like them and you want them there versus players who are in better form and have had better years by various measures. That's where I think there was a conflict on the American side. I'm not taking away anything from Zach Johnson as captain to do what he wants to do because it's his team. But if you set out a philosophy and tell us this is what you're following, and then that philosophy takes a right in that area, I do think that was a problem. And I think it really hurt Team USA. I think the schedule hurt Team USA. That's not necessarily Zach's fault that it's so tight that at the end of the tour championship, nine of the 12 American players hadn't played competitively since the end of the tour championship, whereas all of the European players played competitively after that because the season continued on the DP World Tour, formerly called the European Tour. There was an issue there too. So, and that's not all of them, but there were a number of different points that you can look at in retrospect and say, you know, you feel like in retrospect, you should have seen that coming, but it really did have a material impact on the performance of the team, in my view.
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's talk about the friendship aspect and then the timing aspect of a lack of play with the Americans. First of all, as friendly as many of the American guys are with each other, that is not the recipe for winning a Ryder Cup. And as Justin Rose so eloquently stated in the press conference after the European team won, he said in quotes, a good pairing on the European team does not mean playing with your best mate. I thought that was a direct dig toward what the United States had done. He said it means representing something bigger than yourself. There's two thoughts there. One, as you had mentioned, you can't get your buddies on a team and expect to win. It's not about, you know, having your friends there. You can have good chemistry. If you're a professional and as good as these players are, as great as they are, you should be able to play with anybody, I feel, right? And I just think, as you said, there's just too much emphasis on, okay, let's get your buddy to be your partner and hang with them the whole week. Secondly, when Justin Rose said, it means representing something bigger than yourself. You don't get that feeling from the Americans that they're playing for, you know, something just extremely bigger than them. Instead, you know, you get all, you know, these stories, whether they're true or not, about, you know, the players want to be paid and was Patrick Cantlay protesting by not wearing the hat, all this stuff going on behind the scenes. Whereas the European team, they were a unified group. And I think Lou Donald did a brilliant job, you know, with the videos of Seve and the locker in the team room dedicated to Seve and just uniting this team. They really, you know, they really played for something much greater than themselves, for the guys that laid the groundwork before them and for, you know, the future. And I don't think you get that with this American team. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it depends on how you start to build it, because it is clear, and mark me on this, because you're going to see it happen again and again. The European side will always self-identify as the underdogs. It happens every single Ryder Cup, which is all well and good. Okay, but the broader question there is why? I don't hear it discussed often, but it is clear that the European team, just like Michael Jordan, just like Tiger Woods used to do, they create a chip on their shoulder. And that chip is, we're going to prove to you guys that we're as good as you guys are, or better in the case of a victory. But when you have, and I think, honestly, I think it goes all the way back to the, you can go back as far as the Second World War, when Europe, and particularly GB and I, Great Britain and Ireland, which was the team until 1979 when Europe joined the fold, they were in rubble after the Second World War. The golf courses, many of them were pockmarked with incendiary bombs and that were dropped upon just because they didn't have the guidance and the aiming systems. And so while you have this region and country that are trying to rebuild themselves after their world was destroyed, the American teams came in and destroyed them. Ryder Cup after Ryder Cup after Ryder Cup after Ryder Cup. It's the reason why, when you understand that context, that the concession in 1969 that Jack Nicklaus gave to Tony Jacklin on that last green that resulted in a halve in that match was so profound on the European side, because anyone that looked back in history would go, well, what do you mean that the Americans still retained the Ryder Cup? It was a halve. It shouldn't have been that big a deal. It was a massive, massive deal. And it started wheels in motion that saw its fruition a decade later when, again, Europe came in and joined the rest of the fold. And then as soon as Tony Jacklin took over, he created the framework that became the modern Ryder Cup. So all of that, when you consider how it built together, all of that was based on this idea of we're the have-nots, right? You guys are the mighty United States. You guys are coming in. The PGA Tour is based in the United States. I've talked to old-time European Tour players back in the day that told me the Americans would come in their cashmere and leather bags and new shoes, and we had whatever ragtag we could put together. That mentality is absolutely instilled in the foundation of who the European Ryder Cup team is. I believe that that is the primary motivation at its core as to why, when they come together, they are so motivated as a team, because they are motivated to beat the mighty United States. When the United States faces Europe, they look at it and go, these guys are really good. These guys are some of the best players in the world, and we're going to play as hard as we can to represent the red, white, and blue and to try to win. I'm not one that questions the inner motivation of the players and their desire to win. There may be other peripheral issues running around, like an issue of money, which I think is a conversation that when you hear it, it sounds repulsive for a player to say, I want to get paid instead of just playing for my country, until you realize that there are massive, massive, massive sums of money coming into this event. We are told that all those sums of money go into building the game and growing the game, and you hope that is the case, but there's no verifiable fact of that. And that's where players are starting to go, hey, all we want to know is that what's going on? Or is part of that money building a huge headquarters in Frisco, Texas? They don't know. That's why they're asking that question. And in fairness, those same people, at least evidenced by Stefan Schauffele when he spoke to the Times, father of Xander, he said, look, if you guys open the books and show us where everything is going to charity, our part will go to charity too, just like it is right now. But is that really what's going on when they see the trappings of luxury and first-class tickets and huge gala affairs and massive, massive, massive corporate sponsorships? So from that standpoint, the only reason I bring it up journalistically, although I don't want to see players get paid to participate in the Ryder Cup, but there has to be a balance in terms of the message that's sent forth relative to that. And that's where that's coming from, to understand a little bit better with that discussion and what it means. But when it's all said and done, the American players are coming in and they're trying to win under a united flag of the red, white, and blue. And they're going up against this team that already feels like it's been pushed aside as there's no way you can beat a team that has the firepower of the USA. And that happens every single time. And watch it, because it's going to happen. It's long been my philosophy, and that the success of the European Ryder Cup team, which the world tends to treat as though they have some secret formula that we're trying desperately to figure out what they're doing, when in reality, what they're doing the entire time is right in front of our nose.
Absolutely. Well, you said a lot in that last soliloquy there. Thank you very much, Matt. But let's go back to players being compensated for playing in a Ryder Cup. You know, there's sentiment on both sides. The organizations are making just tons of money for sure. I definitely think they should be more transparent. I know there's money distributed to each player's charity. I personally, like you, I'm against the players getting paid because, as John Rahm said, it's an honor to represent your country. And the fact that they aren't getting paid makes it truly one of the most special competitions in all of sports, right? Playing for sheer pride and bragging rights. But as you mentioned, they're making tons of money. Where's the money going? I think the players have a right to know a little bit more about the financials for sure. So it brings me down to Patrick Cantlay and not wearing the hat and all these reports from Sky saying that Cantlay and his close friend Xander were sitting in a separate area of the team dressing room, that the U.S. were embroiled in an internal dispute. Do you think that was really why Patrick Cantlay was not wearing a cap?
I do think it, based upon the sources that I've talked to, I do believe that that had something to do with it. He was trying to send a message. But if his message was to simply not wear a cap, I don't think it raises the issue to the level of Watergate. I just think it was Patrick Cantlay trying to ask the questions that we just outlined a moment ago to say, if this is this big and if this funding is this big, is this something that doesn't deserve a conversation? A couple of interesting observations relative to that. When you're talking about the European side, unlike the PGA Tour, on the European side, the DP World Tour, formerly called the European Tour, they control that side of the Ryder Cup. So the money that comes in absolutely funds the DP World Tour and has for many, many Ryder Cups been the source of funding that literally keeps that tour operating. So how many are brought joy? And I'm not just talking about fans. I'm talking about playing opportunities from the Challenge Tour on up. How many are brought joy from the fact that that money comes into the DP World Tour so they can continue to exist? So I understand the perspective from European players that go, we're not looking for any money. We're perfectly happy with the way the structure goes, which again, provides from a sensational standpoint, the contrast to the American side, where the American side is going, well, wait a minute, don't we deserve to know where this is going and what the structure is of it? We are living right now, right at this moment, in what I would call a player revolution. And yes, it very much was influenced by what's happening with LIV Golf and the massive, massive sums of money that are coming in from Saudi Arabia. Some will say that players now are getting paid what they deserve. Others will tell you that all it's doing is it's throwing off any sense of balance and equity in the marketplace in terms of what players are really worth given what the marketplace is able to pay. But when you have a source that's coming in with hundreds of millions and potentially billions of dollars, it alters that conversation. So that's the reason why now players are starting to sit back and go, okay, wait a minute. Are players being adequately and fairly compensated for what we do? And it doesn't take a lot of work to do a comparison, say, of the average salary of an NFL player or someone in the NBA or even someone in the NHL and compare where the leading money winner in the world of golf would finish by that. It depends on the sport, but by that judgment, usually someplace in at least 20th, 30th to 50th spot from the top in terms of comparison, in terms of money that's coming in. Now, you could look at that and go, well, that's good. That's part of the appeal of golf. That's part of what makes it so good is that it's not just surrounded by absolutely massive, massive sums of money. But at the same time, you can understand where players are looking at it going, you know, where is the money going? I mean, we're out here doing what we do, but there is a lot of money brought into this thing. It's not all just for stars and stripes. Is it all going towards charity or where is it going? And that doesn't mean that wherever else it's going is something illicit. I don't mean it from that perspective, but I mean from the perspective that we're living in a player revolution where the players want more say. In many cases, they do want more money, but at least they also want more transparency.
Absolutely. And I agree with all that, but I just still am confused why Patrick Cantlay did not wear the cap. Why couldn't they can't take this away from the biggest international competition, you know, there is for golfers. I mean, they can't discuss this away from this scene. He had a not wear a cap, just, you know, and not clarify why he wasn't wearing the cap. If he would have said something, maybe it wouldn't have been so controversial.
Bear in mind, Ann, he didn't wear a cap at Whistling Straits either. And throughout the history of the Ryder Cup, there's so many examples that I would use up all of your time about players who also didn't wear a cap. The contrast to it is that normally he wears a cap, but he has said that it wasn't about that. So from the perspective of, in fairness to Patrick Cantlay, I'll tell you this too.
He said it didn't fit.
Yeah, that's it, particularly on Sunday when he was moving around the golf course, the gallery kept taking their cap off and waving it to him.
It was amazing.
It was the most classic thing I think I've seen on the golf course, because it was they were trying to get inside of his head, but it was the most respectful diss I think I've ever seen. And to his credit, every time they did it, he would smile, he would look up at him, he would wave. And at the end of the Ryder Cup, at the end of the closing ceremony, one of the fans actually threw him a hat and he started to laugh. So he was in on the joke. I should also mention, too, that as the American team were leaving the grounds of the closing ceremony, the fans gave him a standing ovation. So there is that element of class. There is that element of dignity. And in this case, whether you like Patrick Cantlay or dislike Patrick Cantlay, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt to say, well, I do believe that his not wearing a hat was some form of a silent protest. He intended it to be a silent protests. He never put out any press releases, and he never intended it to make it about something that went beyond conversations that were held behind the scenes in the back room.
Yeah. But again, something as little as what that seemed to be initially is huge. And the fact that he's so elusive about it all in the press conferences, even, you know, fuels the fire of intrigue and questions about, you know, what it was all about and et cetera, et cetera. You know, does he want to join Liv? Does he want to take the money? And then, of course, you have Brooks Koepka, you know, on Twitter posting a picture of all these guys wearing, you know, the shirt for his team on Liv. He says, I make money moves. Was Cantlay in that photograph? I don't know if he was or not. Maybe he wasn't.
No, he wasn't in the photograph. But okay. But I could tell you this, Ann, which I'm sure you're going to completely agree with. My producer's name is Dominic Scarano, and he's got a philosophy that says that chaos is good for business. And given the business that you and I are in, which is hosting talk shows such as this, there is so much chaos that surrounds the game of golf right now. It gives us plenty to talk about.
Oh my God. And it's great for our business for sure. It's great fodder for talk shows like this. All right. So what was Joe LaCava thinking when he got in Rory McIlroy's space, of course, waving the hat, going back to the hat after Patrick Cantlay made that third straight birdie putt, and you know, Rory still had a putt to make. Why would LaCava do that?
Well, I think the way that you asked the question answers a lot of it. When you said, what was Joe LaCava thinking? I don't think Joe LaCava was thinking with any particular intent. And what I mean by that is that I saw today for the first time, because I was on course as all this was happening, so I didn't know what was actually taking place. But I have seen videos since that time. And one of the wide shots of the video showed many members of Team USA on the side of the green. They weren't on the putting surface at all, but they were doing the hat thing. You know, they were hats off, which became a theme of this Ryder Cup. And like I said, I thought it was fun, and I thought it was, you know, very amusing. And so the American team was doing that. And I believe that Joe, based upon the angles that I've seen, was doing that to Team USA. And I think Joe was very much swept up in supporting his man, Patrick Cantlay, and supporting the moment. I don't think that Joe meant to offend. Just because we don't mean to offend doesn't mean that you did not. And so I do think that Joe, while he had no intention of doing so, crossed the line of propriety. And that being that he interfered with Rory's preparation to take the putt. Now, having said that, I also think that the emotions in the moment, that Rory also overreacted, and so did to the members on both sides, both Team USA and Team Europe, when it was almost like, to give it a, you know, a baseball parlance, a bench clearing, even though it was by golf terms. So there was a lot of, you know, people with hands up talking to each other like this instead of fists being thrown. So I think that entire incident that took place was an incident that only happened because the emotions of the Ryder Cup at that time. I don't believe that anybody intended it to be the incident that it became, but I also don't think you can discount the feelings that people have in terms of how it impacted them because they were real.
Absolutely. I definitely think it was gamesmanship on Cantley's part. If you go back and not Cantley on the caddy's part, LaCava's part, if you go back and look at that footage, he goes back in to Rory's space after Rory kind of, I think, said something about, you know, can you move? And then he kind of did this like this wave to Rory, like, God, you know, why'd you say that to me? So, yeah, it just seemed like he kind of lost his mind there for a while, the caddy. And, you know, the match was not over. And Rory, as you say, was intent on making that putt. And he didn't want to. Rory had an incredible Ryder Cup. In 7 Ryder Cup appearances, he won 4 or 5 points for the European team. He certainly had the best Ryder Cup to date. Let's look at some of these performances. We'll go back and forth. You covered the Brooks Koepka and Scottie Scheffler foursomes match against Victor Hovland and Ludvig Åberg. Boy, 9-7. What were your thoughts, Matt, when you were watching that and announcing it? 9-7 against, you know, the number one player in the world, Scheffler, and 5-time major champion against a rookie, Åberg. Of course, Victor Hovland is just amazing, but. And I think Åberg is just a superstar in the making. But what were your thoughts when you were announcing that match?
Well, it's funny you asked me about it because in preparation for my show, Fairways Life Today, I grabbed all my score sheets. And you had already seen it. This is the actual score sheet from that match. And when you look at the performance that the European side put together, Victor Hovland and Lucas Åberg, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 birdies in 11 holes, 6 birdies in 11 holes up against 1 for the U.S. side. Now, it's funny because when we look at Scottie Scheffler's performance, and it's impossible to give him a grade of anything better than a D, D minus or F. It's somewhere in that range because of how Scottie performed. But sometimes a player is burdened by who they're with. And in that case, I'm not going to put the blame on Brooks Koepka entirely, but Brooks Koepka was not good. I'll give you just an example of what I mean. When this match was getting to its critical stage, the 8th hole is a par 4. Players, because of how far back they are, can smash it as far as they want, but at 525 yards, they can't reach this huge pond that fronts the green. And they're still going to be left with at best 180 yards into this green that, again, that body of water goes right up to the edge of the green. On the left side of that hole, there's a stream that runs down it. It's not one of these streams that's you know, is heavy when there's a lot of rain. It's running all the time. And on that hole, Brooks Koepka smashed it left. He actually had the ball in the penalty area, in the hazard area, where Scottie, the best that he could do, I'm not kidding you, Ann, as an eyewitness, is advance the ball 30 feet. And when he did it, it still was in the primary rough. From there, now it's Brooks' turn. Brooks hit it to about 90 yards away. Well, again, at that point, the die was already cast because Europe was on the green and 2 putting for birdie. That was at the 8th hole. At the 9th hole, now you had Scottie Scheffler teeing off. Scottie Scheffler blasted it right down the middle of the fairway at the par 5. So Brooks steps up. They had about 295 yards in for their second shot into the green. Brooks stepped up, smashed into it with his 3-wood. Again, it went left, and he found himself in the start, the pool of water that starts the aforementioned stream that ends up feeding that big pond I was telling you about. So again, now they're in trouble. It goes into the water. Now Scottie Scheffler is forced to play a drop there. Meanwhile, while that's going on, the European side are just off the green and 2 putting for eagle. They had a long putt, but they made a birdie and they win that hole. We go to the very next hole, the 10th hole. And I'm not going to go through every hole like this. I'm just telling you, this is how it was going. They go to the very next hole. It's Brooks Koepka on the tee. Brooks Koepka, what did he do? He smashed it left, and it went into the hillside that is part of the visual delineation in terms of how they shaped the 10th hole. Big hillside there, covered with rough that's up to your ankle and some places up to your knee, and that's where he put Scottie Scheffler. The best that Scottie Scheffler could do from there was once again chop it out into the fairway and do the best that he could. Meanwhile, Team Europe are on the green in 2.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's just shocking result. Certainly the biggest winning margin in the history of the Ryder Cup. Just unbelievable. The next day in singles, though, Brooks Koepka beat Ludvig Åberg 3-2. So he won his singles match. So again, Brooks being more of the individual kind of, you know, player, I think more so than a team player. But and then Scottie Scheffler was terrible, winning only 1 point. And I think he will be hurting from this Ryder Cup performance for a long, long time, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a world number one. There is such high expectations, and to the point we were talking about earlier of United States players coming in very, very, very highly ranked and having accomplished great things individually. Here you had another world number one, not different than Tiger Woods in that regard, that goes into a Ryder Cup and does not perform to expectations, as though a world number one ranking or a high ranking in the world rankings in general is somehow a precursor of how one is going to perform in the Ryder Cup, which I think is something that we all need to take a hard look at it and go, you know what? Whether you're 10th in the world or whether you're 30th in the world, the divide between those players is so tiny that in the flashpoint that is the Ryder Cup, there isn't going to be a divide.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to welcome in Catherine Martin, the Minister for Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport, and Media of Ireland. We are at Marco Simoni here in Rome, Italy for the Ryder Cup. It's the Saturday of the weekend, day two of 3 days of Ryder Cup action, and it is such a treat to connect with Catherine again. The last time we actually spoke, we were at Whistling Straits in the United States in Wisconsin.
Yes, and that's correct. But I suppose we were still in the throes of COVID at the time, so it was a smaller scale event, and with very few European supporters were able to travel. So it's a very different scenario here in Rome. We've plenty of supporters for the home team, and really enjoying it. And of course I'm here as Minister for Tourism and Sport, because we will be the next European host nation. I'm really looking forward to 2027, where we'll be hosting the Ryder Cup in Adair Manor, the spectacular setting of the Adair Manor in Anticanti, Limerick.
How has your time been here in Rome, Italy, and what are your thoughts about this venue, Marco Simoni, hosting the Ryder Cup?
Well, it's very interesting to observe it all. I suppose I was invited here to promote Ireland as the next European destination for the Ryder Cup, and I'm here with my delegation, and also there are local stakeholders, I suppose delivery stakeholders, local service delivery stakeholders from the region near Adair, who are here to observe how and what is happening at the Ryder Cup, what it takes to put on such a successful event like this, and it's a huge sporting event. So we will be taking our learnings back. The stakeholders will be taking their learnings back and plan for a successful hosting of the event in Adair Manor in 2027.
I personally love the way Marco Simoni has set this up for the fans, for the spectators, with all the seating areas and the umbrellas. It's been very hot this week. The stage for the opening ceremonies, and they have entertainment every night. And it seems like it's very fan-friendly here at Marco Simoni. So perhaps the Irish will take some of the notes here with this setup to Adair Manor in 2027.
Yes, we're definitely keeping a close eye on how it's running here. And as you said, it's very fan friendly, and I think there's even more screens as well to make sure that that the fans can sit down. So for example, at the I think it's the 13th, 14th, and 15th green, you can have. You can watch there on a screen, but you're also beside the 14th tee box, but also adjacent to the 13th and 15th screens. That's a lot of fans are gathering there because it's so accessible to a lot of the activity. And the opening ceremony was really spectacular, well, and the fans turned up, and even after that closed, there was a DJ, and the fans were still continuing to enjoy themselves. So I'm looking forward to seeing the closing ceremony. So all of this, apart from the actual intricacies of hosting a successful golfing event, from the golfing point of view, we're looking at how much the fans are enjoying this immersive experience.
And especially being so close to Rome, which is such a historic city, there's so much to see. And we enjoyed some time with the Irish at Trinity Pub in the heart of Rome, and it's just always so much fun to get together with the Irish. So for Adare Manor in 2027, I know they have redone the course. They have a new owner in the last several years now, J.P. McManus. I used to play Adare Manor when the Canes owned it, an American-Irish couple from New Jersey. And having gone back, it looks like the Augusta of Ireland. They've made the course just flawless, just perfect. And what are your thoughts about Adare Manor?
Oh, I think people their breath will be taken away when they see Adare Manor. And as you said, from a golf point of view, it is in pristine condition. It is Ryder Cup ready, but also it's the backdrop of the house itself, and the surrounding regions. You know, we are a nation that's very proud. You know, we've over 400 golf clubs on our island. You know, and golf tourism is huge in Ireland, and we have actually one third of the world's links courses as well, from you know, Olehead in Cork to the Royal Port Rush. Well, of course, we'll be hosting the Open again, to Rossapen in Donegal, to Portmarnock in Dublin. No, the list is pretty endless, and so we have. Rome has a lot to offer here to a tourist outside this event itself, and I think Ireland has a lot to really show. And of course, the US tourist typically stays a long time, and of course, a golf tourist will stay a long time when they come to Ireland too. And that's the way to do it, because we have so much to offer from our networks of greenways, blueways, waterways, walkways, you know, and our people are. Or that famous Cade Mila Fault, you know, that which is the welcome that we bring to our music, our culture, our arts. And of course, we're very famous for all that we've produced here from a literary point of view. So we're really looking forward to hosting people. And as I said, a lot to offer in Ireland from a tourism point of view, and Tourism Ireland, that are all island. For tourism is really promoting Adare, and of course the Limerick region too.
I know back in 2006, going way back, I was there at the K Club for the Ryder Cup, and that's in the Dublin area, kind of the southeast area of Ireland. And this is the first time that the Ryder Cup will actually be on the other side of Ireland, in the southwest, at Adare Manor, right? You would fly into Shannon Airport, and it's not that far south of Shannon. It's quite close, actually, but just south of Limerick in Adare. And what will hosting a Ryder Cup mean to that area of Ireland, Catherine?
Oh, there's incredible opportunity there, and we're really looking at what the legacy of this will be for the region. And I know, as I said, there's local service delivery stakeholders here from Limerick, from our Limerick local authority, the county council as well, who are very keen on working with us and working with those in Adare Manor to work on that legacy and building up and taking full benefits of this amazing opportunity of tourists coming to the region. And a lot of tourists will be staying in Limerick and Adare. You fly into Shannon, you can fly into Dublin, get train, buses, you know, you can get the ferry over from Europe. It's very, very accessible, and we're really looking forward to flying into Belfast and come down. So we are a small island, and Adare will be very accessible to all. But I think there's massive potential here on really showcasing that region, of course for all the island, but that region specifically too. And I can't wait to see the images that we see here. There are shots of Rome that you see sometimes when they take the cameras away from the actual action on the golf course, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the images of the local area on the screen in 2027.
Sure, the aerial views and shots of that area of Ireland, of really all of Ireland, would be gorgeous. You know, the greenery, seven or eight shades of green, and the sun will come out, we're hoping, right? I've only been to Ireland when the sun is shining. You know, back in 2019, Royal Port Rush hosted the Open Championship, and that went went remarkably well, especially with Shane Lowry, an Irishman winning. That kind of was the icing on the cake. And the Open will be returning to Royal Port Rush in 2025. So it seems like Ireland is just on this roll as far as hosting major tournaments and in the golf space.
Yeah, and as I said, we are a nation who love golf, but we're a nation that do golf well. With, you know, for an island of our size, with population just over 5 million, to have 400 golf courses on the island, to have one, I think it's an incredible statistic that we do have 1/3 of the world's links courses, and they are spectacular links courses in Ireland. So I think that's why you see such an interest, and of course we have top champions as well, not only the likes of Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy. You see Seamus Power coming up as well, but we also have the likes of Leona Maguire, and we saw the incredible role she played in the Solheim Cup. What's wonderful about these staging these events as well, that it does increase participation in sport. I think with the Solheim and what Leona has done for female participation and just young girls looking on, like, you cannot be, they say young girls cannot be aimed to be what they cannot see. Well, Leona's changing that for the world of female golfers, and definitely in Ireland having a knock on. And then with Shane and Seamus and Rory, and we've many more coming up as well. Even in the Junior Ryder Cup here, there's a Dublin boy who played a key role in it too. So all of that is amazing for participation in sport, and we want more of our teenagers to look at that. It's very important for their physical and mental well-being, and I think golf is a great sport for that.
You know, you mentioned the women, the Irish Women's Open, the Dromoland Castle, and a lot of eyes were on that tournament. And, of course, you mentioned the Solheim Cup, and Leona Maguire played so well in not only this Solheim Cup, but the previous one in the United States. Why do you think golf is such a popular sport in Ireland, and that all these golfers do so well? I mean, for a small country, Ireland has really produced a lot of golfers, male and female, who are on the championship level.
I think it's because we have that it's hard to go far in Ireland without having you don't have to travel far to get to your local golf course, and there is a really community feel to it, and there's a family feel to it as well. So you'll find that the father, mother, and children are all involved, and then that's very much like even my own golf club. There's a golf choir as well, so there's and they compete in choral events. So there's that community sense there in Edinson Golf Club in Rathfarnham. So I just think it's that it's because we've so many, and then golf clubs and of a high quality, and we're very aware of that as a nation. But also we're producing golfers of world class caliber as well, so that's in you know, keeping that spotlight on it for us, and we're good fans, you know, and we get behind and we rally, and that, as I said, that's key to participation as well.
And I also think the accessibility of golf in Ireland is incredible, because when you kind of compare Ireland to the United States, you know, in the United States, they're starting to have more programs for junior golfers now. And I know the USGA is putting together a program to develop junior golfers. But it's harder, unless you're of a certain economic status, to really play the sport, because it's an expensive sport. And in the United States, a lot of private clubs, you know, you have the means to not only play, but buy the equipment and that kind of thing. And I just feel that whenever I go to Ireland and I play in, you know, the beautiful courses throughout the country, you see young people playing all the time. It's just something that they do. It's a sport that they naturally pick up at an early age.
Yeah, I think they pick it up at a very early age, and it could be simply from the pitch and putt courses, and then progressing on to the golf, and kids, you know, children like playing together, so it's a way of catching up and having that 4 or 5 hours with your friends. But there's always, I think, for sporting organisations, we always need to be very aware of how to reach out to more, to make sure that it's never an exclusive club, that everyone has an opportunity, that when they're watching TV, that they think, you know, and they know that they can be empowered to participate as well. And I know, say for example, with myself as minister, we're really upping the funding for women in sport, to increase that participation. That's something that's happened since I became minister for sport. So there are ways of encouraging and even from codes of participation and there's lots of ways to reach out, but I think we should always cognizant that we can always do more.
Yeah, no, I think that inclusiveness is key. And because you're the minister of all sport, not just golf, right? You have to really make sure that that is happening in other sports, right? What is that like in Ireland for women? Are women? I remember when I was just there recently over the summer, there was a major female boxer who was getting more attention, an Irish boxer who was getting more attention than anybody on the sports channels. So it just seems like it's really well accepted in Ireland, women athletes.
Yes, and as I said, it's something that I've been acutely aware of as a female minister of sport, that we need to do more to get more women involved. But we have produced amazing boxers, you know, like Katie Taylor, Kelly Harrington, and it's when we see those, you know, being supported that they do reach the world stage, that they do reach the Olympic stage as well. And then you see incredible change in increase of participation. But my role as minister is to make sure that those women are being supported. And as I said, that's what I've been doing in relation to funding, is increase that funding for women in sport. It's all about the visibility, but you can't get that visibility unless they're being supported from a younger age. And unfortunately, the research shows that unfortunately teenage girls, the drop-off rate in all sports seems to be a steady statistic that we are trying to break through funding initiatives.
Yes, and if they can see other women as mentors and role models, they're more inclined to maybe stick with sport, which is a very important concept. Well, we're here at the Ryder Cup at Marco Simone in Rome, Italy. And speaking of the Irish, Rory McIlroy is having a very good weekend. The Europeans are having a great weekend. It's Saturday morning here. It's 8.5 points for the Europe team to 2.5 points for the U.S. team. I don't know. It just looks like the European team's going to be dominating all weekend long. They're playing incredible golf. And as we've talked about, Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry, and even before you, Paul McGinley, such a Ryder Cup tradition, and Darren Clark and Padraig Harrington. You know, the Ryder Cup has always been important for Irish players.
Yes, absolutely. And as you said, you named a list of golfers over the years that have been that guiding light for us, and that we're incredibly proud of what they're achieving. And Rory and McIlroy and Shane Power or Shane Lowry are certainly on top form today, and we're very proud of Shane and Rory, but the entire European team. And you know, it's such an extraordinary event, and And it's so different for them, and so different for the fans. The way they are participating, by the very nature of the Ryder Cup, that team element to it, and the way there's that team element to all of the Europe versus the USA. And I think it's a very exciting and wonderful event.
Minister, any final takeaways that you think you'll bring from this incredible Ryder Cup venue, Marco Simone, to Adair Manor? Any suggestions? Any things you think you'll bring with you that you'd like to see Ireland do in hosting the 2027 Ryder Cup at Adair Manor?
I think Adair will be a terrific host, and of course we're taking all the learnings away now, how an event at this scale, which seems to be growing all the time and getting bigger and better, we're looking forward to do it, and we will do it in style, and hopefully we take the Ryder Cup this weekend and hold on to it in Adair.
My thanks to Matt Adams, to Catherine Martin, and to Mike Goodsell in production. As the great golfer Bobby Jones once said, golf is the closest game to the game we call life. You get bad breaks from good shots, you get good breaks from bad shots, but you have to play the ball where it lies. Love that quote from the great Bobby Jones. Be safe, be kind, and I look forward to talking with you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Anne LaGorrie.